Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, a shellfish-based remedy for stinky feet, foods to make you live longer, and anti-aging skin creams. Do they really work? We talked to the man who did one of the first proper clinical trials to find out.
We mentioned that this did seem to be able to repair photo-aged skin. And 2 days later, people were queuing around the block to buy this from Boots. Some people were buying it at Boots and then selling it at 3 times the price on eBay.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and with us for this October 2012 edition of Chemistry World are Laura Howes, Bibiana Campuseo and Patrick Walter.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick us off, Laura.
So this is something I found out about when I was in Prague recently for the 4th UChem's Chemistry Congress. I met a Portuguese scientist called Joana Amaral, who works at the Polytechnic Institute of Tomar. And she's looking at using one of the sugars from crab shells and other crustacea to try and make your shoes smell less.
Really? What's the chemical?
So the chemical is chitosan, and that's a polysaccharide which is made from chitin, which is found in the shells of crabs and prawns and various crustacea. This is quite a well-known polysaccharide for various uses, and one of its many uses is that it's antibacterial.
Do we know how?
It basically interrupts the cell wall of bacteria. It breaks it, kills them.
And so how would this be implemented in a shoe?
What Amaral and her colleagues are doing is working to introduce it into the leather at the tanning stage. So actually sort of bind it to the leather as part of the colouring and processing before it becomes a shoe.
Why should that be particularly difficult, or isn't it? Is it just groundbreaking in the fact that no one's done it before?
It's quite groundbreaking that nobody's done it before. People are looking at various sort of improvements to the tanning process to give function rather than just colour. These added benefits are something that's quite new. And chitosan, if you process it in an acidic environment, it will bind to natural products and natural materials. And luckily in the tanning process, they use formic acid. And they have shown that quite simply putting the chitosan in with the other tanning processes gives you a antibacterial leather.
Many people will say that actually leather shoes aren't too whiffy, and in fact it's synthetic fibres, trainers and so on, that are really bad. So could they do the same trick but with a pair of Nikes or Reeboks compared with leather shoes?
I'm not sure about putting it into the processing of the material, but what they are actually looking at is to create a spray version of their chitosan. So hopefully, even if you don't have leather shoes that have been treated in this way, you can give it a squirt and hopefully treat your shoes.
And harmless to the wearer? Hopefully so.
Yeah, chitosan's used in quite a lot of medical devices and implants. It's pretty much safe.
So look out for your chitosan odour-repelling shoes pretty soon. Patrick, not looking at you for any reason other than you have the next story, and sticking with a marine sort of focus.
We have a methane paradox. Around 4% of the world's methane is thought to leak from the oceans, but we don't really know where it's coming from. So the bacteria that produce some methane are known to be anaerobic, so they can't survive in oxygen-rich environments, which is basically what much of the sea is, particularly sort of nearer the surface anyway.
So you're saying there's a sort of paradox in the fact that in the ocean you find a lot of methane in a lot of seawater that's rich in oxygen, and
exactly,
it shouldn't be there. So where's it coming from?
So these oxygenated waters are supersaturated with methane, at least compared to the atmosphere, but no one knew where it was coming from. Back in 2008, another team was looking at oxygen-loving bacteria, and they discovered one that could metabolise methyl phosphonic acid into methane. It was drawing off the phosphate to use for metabolism, and methane was just a byproduct.
Do you find methyl phosphonic acid naturally, though?
but you don't find methyl phosphonic acid naturally. That's the big problem with their theory.
Right.
So if there's no natural source, then how on earth can it be responsible for all this methane coming from the oceans? But what William Metcalf's team from the University of Illinois discovered, well, it's purely serendipity. They're out bioprospecting. They were looking for new antibiotics in the bacteria of the sea. And what they discovered was a cluster of genes that, when they expressed them in E. coli, they actually produced this methyl phosphonic acid.
So there is a natural source then?
So there is a natural source, but it's just been missed all this time.
So the idea they're putting forward then would be that there are bacteria that are oxygen-loving, that have these genes that can make this methyl phosphonic acid, and they then feed that to other organisms that also, in the presence of oxygen,
exactly,
will break it down,
yeah,
and this will yield methane in the presence of oxygen.
And this yields methane in the presence of oxygen. I mean, they estimate about 0.6% of the oxygen-loving bacteria in the ocean could produce this methyl phosphonic acid, so that's really a huge sink for this compound.
So what's the implication of this? Academic only, or does it have a climate change relevance?
Well, it's always very useful to know where the methane's coming from when you're trying to draw up a pie chart of different natural sources and how this measures up against what is man-made. It's probably more than just academic. It is useful.
Patrick Walter, now you've heard of food for thought, but who would have thought that food would begin to border on being considered medicinal? Well, welcome to the world of the nutraceutical, and our guide is...
My name is Amanda Wright, and I'm a faculty member in the Department of Human Health and Nutritional Sciences at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. When people talk about nutraceuticals, they're referring to a biological molecule which is isolated from food ingredients and which has some physiological effects beyond meeting basic nutritional requirements.
To play devil's advocate, Amanda, isn't that actually what food is for?
Absolutely. But we tend to traditionally think about foods in terms of meeting basic nutritional requirements. And then there's been much more interest and research into looking at the intricacies of molecules within foods and identifying what are the specific ingredients that have health effects. And what we've realized is that beyond simply talking about broad classes of macronutrients or even specific vitamins or minerals, there are tons of other molecules that are actually physiologically active and exert some role in nutritional biochemistry and therefore metabolism and health.
How would we use that sort of knowledge?
Industry is very interested in capitalizing on a better understanding of health effects of various molecules and fortifying so-called functional foods, which are foods that, for lack of a better explanation, could contain some added nutraceuticals for an additional health kick, if you will. A lot of people are using nutraceuticals daily as part of their lives now. We see a lot of people, at least in Canada, a lot of people are taking omega-3 fatty acid supplements. Those are considered a nutraceutical. As people are getting older, we've seen people turn to lutein, which is a carotenoid that has strong evidence that it actually can prevent macular degeneration. So people are looking at treating and preventing chronic disease conditions through foods that individually might be known to have some effect.
Is there not a danger that if we enrich for one particular nutrient, yes, it could have a health impact which is positive in certain circumstances for a certain condition, but may also have knock-on effects, making you more at risk, more vulnerable to other problems?
I think that we have to be cautious. We advocate that these molecules have potent effects and can impact health. And so just as we are looking at capitalizing on potential benefits, we need to also recognize that there are two sides to every coin. And I think this is part of what is driving various jurisdictions in the world to better define what nutraceuticals are and how they're going to regulate them. It's certainly not an easy thing, but that's something that's definitely happening in Canada.
So where do you think the really big area for intervention and for nutraceuticals in total is now? Where should we be aiming at, or where have we got the most ground to gain?
A huge area is chronic disease in association with the burgeoning effects of things like obesity and cardiovascular disease, diabetes. These are conditions that come about over a long period of time, related in large part to lifestyle factors, including diet. And so there may be a role for foods and nutraceuticals to potentially alleviate some of that burden. And then I think broadly in terms of where the industry is going, there really is this convergence between food and pharma. We are looking at foods potentially as having therapeutic benefits that we would typically associate with drugs. So there is a lot of research right now looking at understanding better what has the drug industry been doing in order to preserve sensitive molecules and ensure that they are absorbed and that they're bioavailable, and seeking to apply that to potential nutraceuticals.
So are we getting towards a time when, are we going to see an aisle in the supermarket marked old people and you buy ingredients which are enriched for old people in the same way that you see aisles in the supermarket that says for growing teens or something?
I think potentially. I mean, we have sections of our large supermarkets gearing towards that in terms of gluten-free molecules, infant and toddler type foods. We've really moved from a point where I remember growing up and health food stores were they were a real niche market. And I remember going there on occasion with my dad, and there would be these wonderful bins of strange looking herbs and smelling compounds, and similar products are now very mainstream in terms of we can go to our big box stores and purchase fish oil supplements. Or glucosamine or ginseng supplements. Things have really changed. We are certainly seeing the whole idea of personalized nutrition definitely on the rise. It's impacting research in this area. We call this field nutrigenomics, and that is the whole idea of diet, gene, and gene and diet interactions. And people are really mining our understanding of the genome and nutrition to see what polymorphisms would benefit from the consumption of specific nutrients. So there is absolutely an element of this that is going in that direction.
Amanda Wright. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, why some of Van Gogh's sunflowers are going a bit grey with age. But first, this tasty morsel on chocolate. Warwick University scientist Stefan Bonn and his colleagues have found a way to replace the less healthy cocoa butter in a chocolate treat with fruit juice. Bibi.
Well, we all love chocolate and we all enjoy the flavour. One of the main ingredients of chocolate is cocoa butter, which is actually responsible for that melting in the mouth experience and the flavour, the texture as well. The problem with it is that if you're conscious with about your health and your diet, you should be looking to reduce the amount of cocoa butter that you add to chocolate. And obviously, manufacturers are aware of this issue or this problem, and they have made that a priority, so actually making chocolate with less cocoa butter.
But what does that do to the flavour and texture? If it has that very important role, leaving it out must produce a less enjoyable chocolate.
Yeah, what they have done so far is they have replaced the butter with bubbles. The bubbles are quite big.
Of air, yes.
You will be familiar with Aero, for example. They have done it successfully, but what happens is that the consistency is completely different because you have quite a porous and very light chocolate. So far, reducing the size of the bubbles beyond a threshold, which they have identified as 30 micrometers, hasn't been successful. They haven't been able to produce chocolate of good enough quality to manufacture and sell. So these guys have come up with a solution, which is actually produce an emulsion that uses fruit juices. They have been able to infuse the chocolate with that emulsion, and the juice actually is encapsulated in droplets that are of the adequate size to give a good experience when you actually eat the chocolate. So the smoothness and the flavour will be something that you would expect to have when you eat normal chocolate, but this one has been infused with fruit juices.
So what in the fruit juice is doing this?
It's a water and oil emulsion. They've put in the oil phase, they've put sunflower oil, they've put the chocolate, and they've used three different types, so dark, milk and white chocolate. And they also have molten cocoa butter, but as I said before, they've reduced the amount considerably. In the water phase, they've put the fruit juice, they've used stabilizers, they've used chitosan as well, and some food-grade silicates, and that seems to resolve the problem. It makes it into a really sort of homogeneous mixture. So, you know, it makes up for really wonderful chocolate. And actually...
Do you get very, very fruity chocolate?
They say that it could affect the flavour. They've also tried this method with... flat Coke and coffee, and it says that you can actually taste it a little bit, but they tried it with a little bit of pure water with vitamin C, and apparently you can't taste the difference, or it's very, very difficult to do it with, you know, when you compare it to normal chocolate. So it's good news all round.
So diet chocolate's on the way. Bibi, thank you. Patrick, from one thing that's absolutely wonderful to eat to something that you wouldn't want to eat, but it's certainly got an interesting texture when you taste it if you've ever popped a contact lens in your mouth. Hydrogels, and even better ones. Tell us about these.
Right. So hydrogels are extremely useful materials. They have a very high water content, so this makes them great for applications like contact lenses. But the problem with contact lenses, as anyone who's ever worn them knows, is that they tear very easily. They're not very strong. They're a little bit brittle as well, particularly if they've dried out, that is.
So what is the alternative?
Well, an alternative, or at least an interesting new, much tougher hydrogel, is one that's been developed by Qigang Su at Harvard University. He took two types of cross-linked polymer, or at least he took the building blocks of these two polymers, alginate, which is extracted from seaweed, and there's polyacrylamide as well. After he dissolved the building blocks of these two polymers in water and then used UV light to cure them, this creates a cross-linked network of these two polymers, so they're all completely intermeshed with each other.
So you get a mixture of the alginate, which links up one way, and the polyacrylamide, which links up another way, all mixed together. Why is this better than either alone?
So this produces a much stronger, much tougher hydrogel. So this hydrogel can be stretched to 20 times its original length, and then it just snaps back and forms, and you can barely notice any difference in its properties. But what makes this possible is that the polyacrylamide is covalently cross-linked. So these are very strong bonds holding all the strands together, whereas the alginate fibres, the alginate polymers, have ionic linkages between them, so they tend to link up with things like calcium ions. So these are sat between the polymers, and they're kind of weaker. So what happens when this hydrogel is put under stress is that the polyacrylamide holds strong. The covalent linkages keep it in shape, whereas the ionic linkages between the alginates have a lot more give in them. They unzip, so they pop apart, the calcium ions fall away, and this gives the hydrogel much more flexibility than the other ones, which are just usually made of one material, like a polyacrylamide one. And just like an ordinary hydrogel, a polyacrylamide gel on its own would be very brittle. It would suffer from tearing problems just like other ones. So it's this unzipping that makes it much more versatile.
Apart from contact lenses, what else could you do with a material that has these new properties?
The researchers point out that their hydrogel is... 10 times tougher than cartilage, so it's a possibility as a replacement there. I mean, there's other possible biomaterial applications as well.
Ideal, if you want to be stretched to 20 times your original length and then snap back to your original size. I'm just kidding, Patrick. Now, you can't turn back time or defy the ageing process. Or can you? One man became an overnight sensation when he appeared on television with clinical evidence that anti-aging cream appeared to contain more than hype. Chris Griffiths is the Professor of Dermatology at Manchester University.
We were interviewed by the Horizon programme for the BBC Two television. Part of the discussion centred around this over-the-counter product that we'd use, which had been supplied to us by Boots, and we mentioned that this did seem to be able to repair photo-aged skin. And 2 days later, people were queuing around the block to buy this from Boots. Some people were buying it at Boots and then selling it at three times the price on eBay.
Very entrepreneurial. Tell us about the assay that you developed in order to test this stuff in the first place.
Yeah, so the assay is an in vivo assay, if you like, and what we've been able to show is that microscopically in the skin there are two forms of extracellular matrix proteins. These are proteins which give skin its strength and elasticity, and One is collagen, as I've mentioned, and the other are elastic fibers. And there's one particular elastic fiber called fibrillin, and that anchors the upper layer of the skin, known as the epidermis, to the lower layer of the skin called the dermis. And if you think of it like a ground sheet spread on the ground, and the fibrillin fibers are like tent pegs which anchor the ground sheet to the ground. As you age, and particularly if you're sun damaged, you lose those fibrillin anchoring pegs and the skin starts to wrinkle. And we use that knowledge to apply products to sun damaged skin that's on the outer side of the forearm just for up to 12 days under plastic occlusion so we could ensure the product got into the skin and then take a little skin biopsy to ascertain whether those fibrillin fibrils had been repaired and or restored. And we knew that retinoic acid, this gold standard treatment, prescription therapy could do that. And up until that time, there was nothing else that we had seen in that assay and seen under the microscope that could recapitulate the effects of retinoic acid. And to our surprise, this particular product did that.
Now, if this material in the agent that you tested has this profound effect, at what point does it cease to be some kind of cosmetic application and actually be regarded as a medicine? Because the stuff it came from is a medicine.
Yeah, well, cosmetics companies have actually some very good scientists working there. They have been able to, develop some very sophisticated technologies. And I guess that we're in this sort of rather grey area of between what is a cosmetic and what is a pharmaceutical. In the past, cosmetics were used for improving appearance and cleaning or washing the skin and didn't seem to have any significant effects on skin structure. But, of course, that was before the molecular revolution, our understanding that pretty much anything that goes onto the skin can upregulate or downregulate genes. And most things that go onto the outside of the skin can, to some extent, penetrate deeper than just the epidermis. They can go into the dermis. And so as our technologies have got more sophisticated, we can see that there are some perturbations with pretty much anything that goes on the skin, and that's why it sort of moved from being cosmetics to cosmeceuticals.
Were they putting the chemicals into these cosmetics with the intention that they would mimic the science, albeit at a level that was so low that it may actually not really have any kind of effect?
I think that, for the most part, was what was happening, because if you look at some of the ingredients, there's small amounts of collagen in there. We know that putting collagen on the skin topically is never going to penetrate. It's too large. But people, the general public know, oh, yes, if it's got some collagen in, and I've heard that loss of collagen produces wrinkles, therefore putting it on the skin might be beneficial. It's that sort of pseudoscience which was propelling the whole market. And also there were small quantities of retinol in some of these products, but formulated in such a way that they were either just very tiny quantities or they weren't being released from the formulation. Because one of the problems is that you could ask, well, why don't these products all contain all transretinoic acid, which we know works? Well, the problem is all transretinoic acid can, in a fair number of people, cause side effects, irritation of the skin. And a cosmetic company cannot afford for a certain percentage of their customers getting skin irritation. They would have all sorts of claims on their hands.
Where do you think this leaves us then? Are we going to see lots and lots of companies increasingly trying to sneak ingredients in at low level and hope that they choose a cocktail which is underneath the medical radar, so they can still call this a cosmetic, but is just verging on the therapeutic window which you flushed out with the material that you tested?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is that there is a move now towards demonstrating efficacy. And, in the past, they didn't do that. So all of these companies are doing this now, Procter & Gamble, L'Oreal, Boots. And for me, I think that is good. It's very good because it's actually starting to give us good objective evidence as what works and what doesn't work. And on the same time, there's money now being invested in research in skin aging, and we're learning a lot more about the underlying mechanisms as a consequence of that investment.
But most dermatologists still agree that the best anti-aging cream is sun cream. Chris Griffiths was speaking with me from the University of Manchester. Art now, Bibby.
This next story is about the work of Van Gogh and what a group of preservation experts uncovered when they were doing some preservation work at the museum where they work. There is a not very well known, at least I hadn't seen it before, I hadn't seen this painting before. It's a still life called Flowers in a Blue Vase.
What does it look like, this painting?
It's got flowers and they're in a vase.
Oh, well, okay, well, that narrows it down a bit. Why are people interested, apart from the obvious artistic interest, in this particular piece?
It has developed a mysterious grey crust on its surface. So
all over? Or just in certain places?
Just certain places, yeah. The experts were actually looking at it and they realised that this grey crust appeared where the cadmium yellow used to appear.
So the cadmium yellow is a pigment that gives a certain colour.
Yeah, a very intense bright yellow, yes. So where this paint containing this pigment had been applied, they could see actually that not only it had lost colour, but it had also started flaking off. So they were quite worried that there was something happening there.
And they knew it was the cadmium yellow, or did they just know that it seemed to be those bits of the picture that were susceptible?
They knew it was the cadmium yellow. Cadmium yellow is made of cadmium sulfide, which actually oxidizes to cadmium sulfate in the presence of water, moisture, oxygen and UV radiation as well. So they knew that that process happened. But obviously there was something unusual there because cadmium sulfate tends to be white, but the flakes that they were getting on the paint were grey. So they sent a sample, a tiny, tiny sample of the paint to a group of chemists. They were led by Geert van der Snicht from the University of Antwerp, and they basically identified that the main compound of that flake of paint was cadmium oxalate.
Where did the oxalic acid come from then?
The theory is that an earlier preservation attempt used a varnish that contained some form of oxalate and also a lead-based drying agent, that the cadmium reacted with the oxalate and the lead reacted with the sulfate to produce lead sulfate. So you have
Which is the grey stuff.
Is the grey stuff. So you have a mixture of that there. And so they've been able to identify this previously unknown route for the degradation of cadmium sulfide.
Can it be reversed?
I don't think it can be reversed. I think this study highlights we need to be quite careful when we're doing restoration work, that all these factors are taken into account.
It's like artistic forensics, isn't it? Laura, tell us about graphene now. This is fascinating. So you can actually change how graphene behaves based on what it's sitting on.
Yes, we talk a lot about graphene. But one of the interesting things about graphene that people have been puzzling about is that depending on what the graphene sits on, the substrate that it sits on, that can actually change its chemical properties.
So you have a sheet of graphene, and then underneath that is some kind of substrate that it's sitting on, which is not actually chemically involved in what you're studying.
Yeah,
something weird happens to the graphene.
It's just a support, because obviously graphene is this one atom thick sheet. To do anything with it, you're going to need to sit it on something just to give it some stability. And yes, it's a very interesting property. So
in what way does the graphene change its behaviour?
So, for example, we very often put graphene on silicon dioxide. Silicon dioxide is a particular type of semiconductor. We use it a lot in the electronics industry. And we know that, if anything, it should draw electrons into its lattice. And that, if you would think it through logically, you would think, OK, so the silicon dioxide would draw electrons, and therefore that would reduce the reactivity of graphene. And actually the converse is true.
So how do you explain that then?
So Michael Strano and his team at MIT in the US have been looking at this. And what they've found is that actually it's because there are impurities in the silica. And it's these impurities that actually cause the electrons in graphene to puddle. They call it electron puddling. The electrons sort of come together.
You get a sort of hot spot.
You get hot spots of electrons, which makes the graphene more reactive because you've got more electrons at that place.
And if they now understand how that happens, does this mean we could actually make functionalized substrates to put the graphene on so that you can control what graphene does and make these puddles occur in certain places?
Absolutely.
To control?
Potentially, instead of trying to pattern and functionalize your graphene, which can be an issue, especially if you're looking at functionalizing it with molecules that are very sensitive to reactions. Like, so if you're functionalizing your graphene with peptides, for example, that can be a problem. Maybe you can make your life easier for yourself by changing the substrate that it's sitting on, maybe patterning it so you've got raised bits and lowered bits, or, you know, something like that. And that can actually change the reactivity of the graphene on top and make your graphene reactive in different ways.
Is this actually practical, though? Are we going to have to position individual atoms or something in certain places to get this to happen? Or is there a way around this?
Strano and his team have actually shown that by using a sort of a simple stamp to sort of add some molecules to a substrate with a sort of an ink, you pick some of that up, stamp it onto your silica, some of those will be transferred in a quite simple sort of lithography type process. Then you've changed the property of the substrate quite simply, and then that has changed the reactivity of the graphene and how the patterning.
Fantastic. I don't think it'll be long before that gets implemented, actually, will it? Because, I mean, that sounds really groundbreaking in terms of being able to manipulate graphene in a way we hadn't previously anticipated.
It's not only is it quite surprising that you can alter the reactivity so much, but it's really important because we're looking at using graphene for many, many things, many sensor applications. And I can't help but think that people are going to be probably scrabbling away in their labs right now trying to implement this.
Well, implement this for us, which is our, I suppose, the chemical equivalent of thought for the day, our trivia. What have you got for us?
So our trivia this month is an interesting follow-on from graphene and something that has been shown and people are probably going to try and implement it very, very quickly. It was, in fact, 100 years ago that Giacomo Chiamanchian published in Science saying that he thought that one day the human race could directly convert sunlight to fuel.
So was that the sort of birth of the photoelectric cell, or the whole idea of electrolyzing water using energy from sunlight?
So Chiamanchian, he's often called the father of photochemistry. He did a lot of work looking at quite simple organic compounds and shining light on them and seeing what happens. And even from these very basic early experiments, he could see the potential for photosynthesis being used. In his article in Science, which was published on the 27th of September 1912, he described it as the guarded secret of plants. And I think it's quite interesting that while he published this 100 years ago, we can do that in the lab. We can't yet do that on an actual scale. We have photovoltaic cells that can create electricity, but we can't directly convert sunlight into a fuel that we can put in our cars to fuel our life.
But hopefully we have fueled your brain and your passion for chemistry. Thank you, Laura, and thank you also to Bibi Campaseho and Patrick Walter and our guests this month, Chris Griffiths and Amanda Wright. The production was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. We're back next month with more top stories from the world of chemistry. For now, though, thank you for listening and goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.